So then you were a tank platoon leader. What was your first engagement? What was your first job then once you became involved in Korea?
We went up and relieved the 1st Cavalry Division, but our battalion was assigned to the 1st Division of the Republic of Korea, the South Korean Army, to help support them because they didn't have any tanks, and our own division had other tanks. Every regiment had its own tank company. So we wound up, the tank battalion, supporting Korean troops. We went into a line there near Shorewon, which is remembered as the little town that was shot to pieces, and the Americans lost it in the first stages of the war, and General Dean, division commander, was captured there. Then my platoon rotated with other platoons in various places along the line, and we went up along the Imjin River, where South Korean troops were defending this, and we supported them. These tanks were dug in, and we had bunkers behind them to live in. It was more like World War I than anything anybody had seen in World War II. The line had been stable for a long time. Bunkers were built of logs and sandbags and dug in. The enemy the same. We sat there and looked at one another most of the time, and if we saw something to shoot at, we'd shoot at it. If we didn't, sometimes we'd just try to break up a bunker. The enemy had artillery. He had tanks, but he never brought them out in the daylight. We had air superiority. But he had deadly mortars. They could operate those in daylight because they could conceal them. And that was probably the worst thing. That and mines bothered us. Task Force Hobart was our first offensive operation where we went out of our own lines and into enemy territory. That was just a big reconnaissance in force. I never did know what the purpose of it was unless it was just to capture prisoners. Always a demand for prisoners. The intelligence people wanted them to be able to keep up with who's in front of us there and identify units. Order of battle, they call it. That was called Task Force Hobart, named for the hometown of Company C, which was headquartered in Hobart before it was mobilized. And that was my company. That was the first time that we ever got out of our main line there and went forward into enemy territory. We didn't suffer any casualties in that. It was considered a success, and I wrote a piece about it for the 45th Division News. Almost got court-martialed because since they asked me to write it, I thought it was all right and that it was approved. But I found out afterwards that I should have checked with my own commanding officer and my own battalion commander in the 45th Division before I published anything like that. And they were pretty upset about it, but nothing came of it.
Were they upset because you did it or you gave away information?
Well, both. It was against the rules, for one thing, and also it gives the enemy too much information. It's got a number of hills in it and the identification of places and everything. And that did provoke the enemy to mention the thing and gave him some information to use on his propaganda radio, English language radio broadcast that they had up there.
So you knew they were taking information from your story?
Yes, they knew who we were, so they mentioned us in particular. This is what really bothered the brass. They don't want to give the enemy the name of a unit or identify anything that they don't have to.
Were you talked to directly about this? And,
yes.
And how did it make you feel?
My battalion commander just chewed me out about it real good and said, don't ever do this again. And of course I didn't, but that was my one experience as a war correspondent. I came out all right. The colonel was very decent about it.
Somewhere in there, you received the Bronze Star with V for action.
Well,
what was that about?
That was in the first week of July of 52. 1st Rock ROK Division was assigned to take actually 7 fortified places out there on high ground in front of our line that they wanted to have when the war came to an end. Remember, the Panmunjom peace talks were going on at this time, and both sides were scrambling to get the high ground that they wanted to occupy if they had a settlement. So the South Korean infantry attacked this area out there, and I was the commander of the tank support unit that went with them. I had my platoon and another platoon, 10 tanks, and we went out there. This is high ground, mountains really, that just crop up out of the plain there. And these infantrymen would try to struggle up there and get into these enemy trenches and bunkers and get control of these mountaintops, and we're down below firing at targets on top that we can see without hitting our own men. That lasted all day and into the evening, and then late in the day, we just got orders to pull back. They didn't have all the objectives, but they just quit. Meanwhile, my tank, the track had come off of it. We were trying to turn around with mines on both sides of us, and they just pulled it loose. So I had to be towed out of there, and I had to help put the track back on. We couldn't get it on where it would work, but we did get it on where we could tow the tank easily. The interesting thing was I'd been told a few days earlier that I was going to leave, that my time was up and I could go home, rotate, they call it. Then they came back just a few hours later, and the adjutant said, "I'm sorry, but you can't go back because this operation's on, and you're the only one who's done the reconnaissance and the work on it, and you're going to have to go out there." I said, "Okay."
Well, it was more than an okay. What a letdown that was.
Well,
for you.
A letdown. I'd written my folks and tell them I'm coming home.
So now in 52, you are
22.
So then you had to stay.
I had to stay for this. That worked out all right. So then I came home the day after that. But I did have time to watch these big other operations on this big offensive. Watched the 45th from a distance open up with their guns to try to get some of this high ground on their front. Remember, we were adjoining them with the South Korean troops. And I was told at the time that it was the biggest artillery barrage that had been fired up to that time. They had brought in trucks from other units in order to haul ammunition. They set up service stations, including tire-changing places, to serve these trucks to haul shells to these guns. They fired everything that you could think of at the Chinese for, oh, I don't know, for, seemed to me like for hours. I never really knew how all that came out. That was my last memory of action in Korea.
I remember as a youngster hearing about the Korean War, and it was always about the 38th parallel. Uh-huh. Talk to us about that.
That was the dividing line informally agreed upon between the United States and Soviet Union for who would occupy Korea, which had been previously occupied by the Japanese. And then the government of North Korea talked Stalin into supporting an attack on South Korea. We had advisors there. It was not formally a part of our occupied territory by treaty or anything like Japan or Germany, but we were just there with advisors to the South Korean army. This was a kind of a surprise attack. Since it was supported by Stalin, President Truman felt we didn't have any choice but to try to stop them and turn them around. So he was told about it. He says, "Well, you'll have to stop the so-and-sos, and that's all there is to it." Well, that was the order they had. In the long run, we did stop them, and South Korea became, as everybody knows, a model democracy and an industrial giant in many ways. And North Korea remained and remains today one of the most backward, dangerous places on earth, I guess.
General Eisenhower made a presence there in the Korean War.
Yes.
What are your recollections of him?
Well, he campaigned on the promise that if elected, he would go to Korea. And he didn't say what he would do there or how he intended to end the war, but just the fact that he was Eisenhower, that was good enough for the public. So he was elected, and he was president-elect. He had made this promise, and he went to Korea and visited there very briefly. He went up to the front and looked at things, and then he came back. He had concluded probably before he went that it was hopeless to try to win a war there and to enlarge a war with China. We had a rule, an ironclad part of doctrine in those days, was don't get in a land war on the continent of Asia. We'd already been in one out there in the Pacific with Japan and to a certain extent in China. So we pull back to the 38th parallel. We already were on the 38th parallel, more or less, and we decided just to stay there. And we opened up negotiations. At one time while I was there, we even had a unilateral ceasefire. We just ceased fire and ceased all offensive operations along our front. That must have been April of 52, to see how the enemy would react, that maybe we could just work out, as had been done before, a de facto truce, no paper signed or anything. But that didn't work. After about 10 or 15 days, we had to go back in business.
So you were hoping during that time, of course, that maybe they'll get the message.
Well, if they had just pulled back like we did and ceased fire, but they made it a point to maintain enough hostile patrolling activity and occasional fire to say to us, we're not going to buy this, we want a better deal. The Admiral Turner Joy, who was in charge at Panmunjom, John, our chief negotiator, said, one reason we had to worry about places like Pork Chop Hill and some of these other places we were fighting over there during this period was not just the military value, but we have to show the Chinese that we can bleed as well as they can. I've often thought about that.
Mm-hmm.